This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, the story of the real star of Saturday Night Live.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
For 50 years, every Saturday night across America, you could turn on your TV and possibly bear witness to a new comedy classic getting minted on live television. The show has had 167 cast members over the years and nearly 300 writers, many of whom have gone on to become huge stars. And ahead of this weekend's three-hour-long 50th anniversary broadcast, some of the show's biggest names are sharing their favorite moments. Like Seth Meyers remembering Molly Shannon doing her character Sally O'Malley.
I guess it was the Betty White show you did Sally O'Malley, and you were pulling your pants up. What you were revealing to the audience, it was just the audacity and the joy.
My name is Sally O'Malley. I'm proud to say I'm 50 years old. I'm not one of those gals who's afraid to tell her real age, and I like to kick, shred,
Amy Poehler, who says whenever she's sad, she watches Rachel Dratch doing Debbie Downer.
The combination of Rachel's face, because she's like a silent film star, and then knowing that every time the camera's going to zoom in and she's laughing, the combination of the sound effect and the expectation of the zoom and the laughing.
I guess Roy isn't doing as well as they first thought. What?
Who's Roy?
Roy of Siegfried and Roy. He was attacked by his own tiger and suffered devastating injuries.
Leslie Jones's favorite moment is Kenan Thompson playing a lobster in a diner parodying Les Miserables.
I've seen so many great moments with Kenan, but to see him and know why he is who he is, the brick of, like, the building, when he played the frickin' lobster.
Who am I? And why am I condemned to boil alive?
It was frickin' brilliant. Everybody was like, this dude is like the best in the business.
And through all the years, every single one of these sketches, cast members and writers, was handpicked by one executive producer. The one who pioneered the vision for what Saturday Night Live could become and remains its singular deciding voice, Lorne Michaels.
Most of the world, they don't know who he is because he has intentionally stayed behind the curtain like the Wizard of Oz.
That's Susan Morrison, who spent years talking to and shadowing him for her new book called Lorne, The Man Who Invented Saturday Night Live.
In all the years that he's produced SNL, Lorne has never missed a Saturday night. He's never been home with the flu. He's always there.
Susan told me that Lorne was always ahead of his time, even before SNL, when he was working on old-fashioned variety shows.
In the 10 years before he created SNL, Lorne worked in Hollywood on a whole spate of really dreary or shop-worn, middle-of-the-road variety hours. He was always the youngest person in the writer's room. And he had this idea that there's no reason why couldn't television catch up with the rest of the culture? Why couldn't it create material that would appeal to his generation? He always talks about how, as he was working on these shows, they were watching Watergate. They were watching, you know, Nixon helicoptered off the White House lawn. They were watching the FBI break into SLA headquarters looking for Patty Hearst. And you didn't see any of this on television. Mm.
So how did he do it? How did he get SNL greenlit?
So for a while, he shopped this show around to various executives, and they just stared at him blankly and said, next. You know, his show might have been cool, but it didn't solve any problems for them. The reason the show got greenlit is because in 1975, Johnny Carson, who was NBC's biggest star, got cranky about the fact that the network was showing two Tonight Show reruns on the weekends. So NBC basically had a problem. They had to fill these weekend hours. And Herb Schlosser, who was a young kind of visionary president of NBC, had this idea of creating what he called a time of day show that would fill the Saturday night slot in late night. And to cut to the chase, Lorne was trying to pitch this show without any success. And he thought, well, maybe this is the place. Maybe this is the place for it. And Lorne, who had never considered late night, you know, he was always thinking about prime time, suddenly realized that late night was a place where you could kind of get away with anything because none of the executives, none of the grown-ups would really be paying attention. He called the late night slot, he compared it to a vacant lot on the edge of town. When he described his show to the NBC executives, he said he wanted it to look as if the adults had gone home and a bunch of kids had come in and taken over the studio.
So how did those first few episodes go? Take us back to how things were starting to take shape in the first season.
So no one expected that this would be a hit. They just figured, let's try this. And the first couple of episodes were rocky. Some people thought they were terrible. There were lots of complaints. You know, George Carlin, the first host, did some monologues that upset Catholics enormously. But because they were left alone, they were able to just, you know, it was a laboratory. They were making it up as they went along. The other thing Lorne realized about the show being live, you know, if you do a pilot, you give your pilot to the middle-aged network guys, they focus group it. You know, you basically have to deal with something that's almost like a McKinsey report telling you what to cut and what to do and what to change. And by having the show be live, he wouldn't have to do any of that.
Right.
And he retained a lot of control.
It's funny, thinking about the very first episode and how it came together and watching that cast and watching those writers gel and that alchemy that was happening at the time. So many people still describe the process as being quite similar to the chaos of that very first episode, which is to say that even up until the last minute, it sounds like Lorne is walking around the studios going, we have no show, which I found really funny to think about.
That's right. The show has basically been done the same way for 50 years, which is Monday, there's a meeting with the host. The host comes in, everybody crams into Lorne's office, many of them sitting on the floor like kindergarten students. And the idea with that meeting is just to make the host feel comfortable with the group and to have a sense that they're going to have his or her back. Tuesday, they write. Wednesday, there's a read-through. The sketches are culled down to a smaller number, but many, many, you know, at least a dozen sketches are blocked, rehearsed, costumed, sets built. Now, one of the things that people in the current group of writers said to me is, you know, they would see him on Friday looking at the index cards on his bulletin board where he has the sketches arrayed in three acts and still seem scared. You know, the idea that after 50 years, he cares so much that he could still feel on Friday morning like, oh my God, I don't have a fucking first act. You know, on Saturday, there are only going to be about 8 or 9 sketches. So it's kind of like the Hunger Games, you know, every day of the week or Survivor, you know, more people get voted off the island. And so built into the system is a sense of competition and wanting to please him and wanting to make him laugh. Lorne likes to think of his show as an egalitarian show, as a show where every person is as important as everyone else. You know, the cue card guys, the costume assistant, the writers, the cast, everyone has something that they have to do that contributes to the show getting on the air. And in meetings, he makes a point of asking everyone's opinion. And then on Saturday at 8 o'clock, when dress rehearsal begins, there's a complete about face, and he is 100% in control. He's filed away everybody's opinions, but then it's really just him reacting to the comedy. He sits under the bleachers in Studio 8H, watching the show, the dress rehearsal, on a monitor. He takes note of what the dress audience laughs at, and he will see a million more things than the writers see. He'll be hearing the jokes and the rhythm and what gets laughs, but he'll also be looking at the couch and whether the camera cut to a closed door and whether someone's entrance was late, or in an episode that I sat under the bleachers with him at when Jonah Hill hosted, Jonah was wearing this ridiculous man bun in a sketch. And it was so silly that it in Lauren's view, it distracted from the rest of the comedy. He was worried that people would be thinking, oh, look at that ridiculous wig. So his note in a situation like that would be, lose the wig. The wig is starring in the sketch.
Yeah.
And for him, the idea is always protecting the comedy.
Tell me a little bit about the reception of the show in its early years. I mean, it sounds like Lauren was trying to do a lot of things at once. He was trying to do something that felt very avant-garde. He was trying to identify writers that typically would not work in TV and bring them onto his staff.
Right.
But at the same time, he seemed and has always seemed, according to your book, keenly aware that he is putting on a show that has to be played in all 50 states, right? It's something that he says a lot.
Yes.
How does he kind of strike that balance politically and culturally and all else?
I think in the first 5 years, he was very keen on creating a show that he and his friends wanted to watch. You know, he didn't care about the executives or the research. He just wanted to do something that he and his friends would laugh at, that would make them laugh in the writer's room. I think he did feel that, you know, everybody who was 23 would be laughing at Dan Aykroyd's impersonation of Jimmy Carter talking someone down off a bad acid trip on his radio show.
Just remember, you're a living organism on this planet, and you're very safe. You've just taken a heavy drug. Now, just relax. Stay inside and listen to some music, okay? Yeah. Do you have any Allman Brothers?
As he got more and more experience, I think he did recognize that he wanted it to be cool, but he didn't want it to be too niche. You know, he's always been a fan of what he calls broadcast, which is almost extinct at this point. You know, the idea that everyone in America sits down and tunes into a show at the same time. But he always compared it to the way the railroads unified the United States in the 19th century. It was something that kind of brought everyone together. And when he says we're on in all 50 states, I don't think he means you have to dumb it down. I think he means that you have to just recognize that you don't want to be clever for the sake of it.
You know, one thing I loved reading about in the history was when it first aired, one of the earliest episodes, if not the first episode, somewhere in the country, Steve Martin, young comedian Steve Martin, was watching TV and thinking to himself, you know, I'm at the real cutting edge. I'm pushing the limits of comedy here. And he sees SNL and goes, oh, my God, they beat me to it. They did it. They put it on TV. And of course, Steve Martin went on and has gone on to be one of the most frequent hosts of SNL, a very celebrated host of SNL. I reminded myself, I rewatched the King Tut sketch.
So genius.
Classic Steve Martin, right? Where he starts out, he comes on stage, he starts out very reverent, talking about how it's you know, such a shame that we've commercialized Egyptian history.
I tried to use the ancient modalities and melodies. We'd like to do it for you right now. Maybe we can all learn something from this.
And then he launches into this incredibly goofy. I mean, the lyrics are so funny, the song that he comes up with.
King Tut. How'd you get so funky?
Funky Tut.
Did you do the monkey?
Born in Arizona, moved to Babylonia, King Tut.
I wonder if you have favorites that are along these lines from SNL history. Favorite commentary, favorite oddball sketches that stand out to you?
Well, first, one of the interesting things about Steve Martin and the show is that, yes, he was selling out stadiums. You know, he made comedy into rock and roll, which is just what Lauren was trying to do, too. But at the very beginning, various people were pitching Steve to Lauren for the original cast, to be a guest host. And Lauren didn't get Steve. You know, he would see him on a TV show with the arrow through the head or the bunny ears, and he just dismissed it as kind of prop comedy. And it wasn't until a year later in the second season that he really started paying attention to what Steve Martin was doing, which was much more kind of meta, subversive, turning a lot of conventions of comedy on their head, that Lauren realized, wait a minute, he is on our wavelength. And so then he finally booked Steve as a host, and of course that was, you know, a chocolate meets peanut butter moment. Changed history. But as to my favorite sketches, boy, there are so many. One that I love, which I don't think is known well enough, is called Change Bank. And it was written by and stars Jim Downey, who isn't seen that much in sketches because he was the head writer. but it's what you'd call a room temperature piece. It's a fake advertisement for a bank whose only purpose is to make change.
I needed to take the bus, but all I had was a $5 bill. I went to First Citywide, and they were able to give me 4 singles and 4 quarters.
It's very earnest. It's what Downey calls a method that he calls deliberately wasting the audience's time. And the notion is that in a very calm way, you start explaining something that really needs no explanation.
Sure.
With our experience, we're going to have ideas for change combinations that probably haven't occurred to you. If you have a $50 bill, we can give you 50 singles. We can give you 49 singles and 10 dimes. We can give you 25 twos. Come talk to us.
And it just goes on
explaining
and
how to
on
make change
and
right on.
And it's so brilliant. Right. I'm also a huge fan of Celebrity Jeopardy, which was Will Ferrell as Alex Trebek. And
sure. In
the SNL lingo, that's what they call an impression parade.
Welcome back to Celebrity Jeopardy. Sean Connery has set a new Jeopardy record with negative $230,000.
You think you're pretty smart, don't you, Trebek?
What with your basically, in any given cast, everyone has impressions that they're especially good at. So these days, you might have something which is like, you know, everyone auditioning for Wicked or something, and an opportunity for cast members to haul out their great impressions. Well, Celebrity Jeopardy was that, you know, and probably the best part of it was Norm MacDonald doing his Burt Reynolds impression. And he always insisted that he wasn't Burt Reynolds, but he was Turd Ferguson.
Hey, check out the podium. Look at this.
Mr. Reynolds has apparently changed his name to Turd Ferguson.
Yeah, that's right. Turd Ferguson. It's a funny name.
Another thing that I love, I mean, political humor is an incredibly important part of the SNL arsenal. And two that I love, which are really conceptual, and I like them because they're not standard issue political satire. There is one on in the Reagan administration that was mostly written by the genius Robert Smigel, who a lot of viewers know from creating Triumph the Insult Comic Dog on Conan O'Brien's show. Mm-hmm. But the Master Brain sketch showed Phil Hartman as Ronald Reagan. And the idea was that behind closed doors, he was actually a genius, a political strategist without peer, someone who could calculate enormous sums in his head. And you'd see him meeting with his cabinet, calculating, you know, all kinds of important offensives.
All right, let's get down to business. I'm only going to go through this once, so it's essential that you pay attention. One, Casey.
Yes, sir.
You'll spearhead our new operation to fund the Contras. The C-5As with the tow missiles and grenade launchers
then,
will leave for
South... And there's a knock on the door, and an aide says that the Girl Scouts are here to see him for a photo op, and they come in, and he reverts back to the doddering, avuncular Reagan that we all know.
This is the part of the job I hate.
Hello, little girl. What's your name?
Lisa Myers.
Well, Lisa, if you're that good a sales lady, maybe I could use you up on Capitol Hill.
And it was just so unexpected. And I love that. And similarly, go forward 30 or so years, there was a writer on the show named Julio Torres, who
yes.
did things
He's
that...
written some of my favorite sketches, I have to say.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, he reminds me a little bit of Jack Handy in that there's something almost psychedelic about the strangeness mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. the worlds that he created. And he wrote a sketch, it was a series called Melania Moments that I thought was so great because it was Melania, I think played by Cecily Strong. It was a dreamy atmosphere and you could see her in Trump Tower sort of as a damsel locked in a tower. And it's this almost quaalude-y kind of voiceover of Melania just trying to kind of figure out the world, looking out over Fifth Avenue and wondering, is there such a thing as Sixth Avenue?
She saw a man walk just out of sight and wondered, what happens to them, to the people, once they leave Fifth Avenue? Where do they go? Do they disappear? Is there a Sixth Avenue?
There was a criticism by some of the old-timers of the show's political coverage during the first Trump administration. I mean, of course, Alec Baldwin was brilliant as Trump. But the trouble with doing political satire in the age of Trump is that there's a comedy term, jumped the shark. I mean, it's so extreme that you can't really make fun of it.
Yeah,
I mean,
how do you write for it?
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes then, and we'll see what happens in this administration, there was a criticism that the Trump coverage was almost too beat for beat. You know, Trump, he's almost like his own comedy writer. The stuff he says is so outrageous that it's hard to know how to be satiric about it. But some Melania moments just was something completely out of left field. You know, it wasn't just attacking or making fun of Trump the way The Daily Show might or something for his policies. It was something that was much more abstract, but I think devastating in its own way.
Mm. Have you spoken with Lorne or any of the writers about writing political satire for this time? Just the challenges of doing that?
I talked with a lot of the writers and Lorne about writing for Trump earlier, and I know that for a lot of the writers in the first Trump administration, they were shocked that the president was paying so much attention to SNL. Now, it's yet to be seen how he's going to respond to this season. But in his first term, he was tweeting about SNL every week, collusion with the Democrats. He was ordering FCC investigations. And a lot of these writers who were pretty young, I remember one of them saying to me that it was kind of terrifying to realize that the president was paying more attention to SNL than he was to ISIS or to gun violence or to the Middle East. And it's a strange thing for a comedy writer to feel really in the middle of the international conversation.
Are there any moments in SNL's history that you would point to and say, actually, this did change the national conversation? This did move the needle in some way.
Well, Howard Kurtz, the longtime Washington Post media reporter, coined a term that he called the SNL effect about 20 years ago. There was a time when television debates were becoming more and more central to the dialogue that a lot of people really took their cues from what they saw on SNL. During the Bush-Gore race, Jim Downey wrote a series of debate sketches that I think a lot of viewers confused with reality.
Classic debate sketches.
Even George Bush, I think, confused them. Jim came up with a term that Bush, played by Will Ferrell, used in the SNL debate sketch called strategery.
In fact, we are almost out of time, so I will instead ask each candidate to sum up in a single word the best argument for his candidacy. Governor Bush?
Strategery.
And I think a lot of American citizens think that Bush really said that. And later, Bush said, didn't I really say that? I mean, he was confused.
It morphed into his own memory.
And Gore, who was portrayed by Daryl Hammond as just this highly intelligent but extremely wooden, unempathic kind of character, the term that summed up his personality was lockbox.
But I will not reply in kind. Instead, I will take those remarks and put them away. Away in a tiny lockbox where all bad thoughts go.
I've heard a rumor that, in fact, Gore's team had him watch some of these sketches just to tell him how he is coming across to people and maybe advise him on what not to do or how not to seem.
That's right. Gore was played. His handlers made him watch some of these sketches. And his response was, I think I'm going to be a little bit less stiff next time. Yeah. So, you know, they did learn from that. Another one that I thought was really interesting was in the primaries when Obama and Hillary Clinton were both in the primaries running for the Democratic nomination. The show noted something that the rest of the media didn't really pick up on, which is the kind of media bias toward Obama as this glamorous newcomer.
I myself have been clinically diagnosed as an Obamaniac. While my associate John King just last week suffered his third Barack attack.
And Hillary Clinton at that point was treated a little bit like an old shoe, you know, Whitewater, the discussions about her hair bands and how she stood by Bill after the Lewinsky scandal. And there was a great debate sketch that showed all the moderators just fawning over Obama as if he were Justin Timberlake or something.
Senator Obama, are you comfortable? Is there anything we can get for you?
And Clinton noted it in the real world and at the next debate actually referenced it, said something like, do you want to see if Barack needs a pillow or something like that? So the idea that even the candidates would be taking cues from this dialogue and that it really was setting up the political discussion throughout the country is kind of amazing. Mm. I mean, I think that took everyone, including Lauren, by surprise.
You know, I think a lot of people have come to know so many of the names that come out of the SNL writers' room over the years, but perhaps at the time that they were on SNL, they weren't so well known. Is there anyone among the cast or writers today that you think is a little under the radar that people should know? People should remember that name.
I think Marcelo Hernandez is a real standout this year. And one of the ways that people become stars on the show or break out on the show traditionally has been by doing these weekend update spots. And part of that is that they're sitting looking into camera and they say their own name to the audience. Mm-hmm. And that's how Chevy Chase became a star in the first season. He said, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. That's how, you know, Adam Sandler became a star by sitting at that desk with his guitar and saying, I'm Adam Sandler. I'm singing his ridiculous Thanksgiving song. So that is a tried and true way for people to kind of connect with the audience. In the second season, when Bill Murray was a new cast member, the audience didn't really like him at first. They missed Chevy Chase, and they thought, why did this guy come and replace Chevy Chase? So Lorne had the idea, working with Bill, to write a monologue for him to say to the audience.
Hello, I'm Bill Murray. You can call me Billy, but around here everybody just calls me the new guy. I want to thank the producer, Lorne Michaels, for urging me to speak with you directly. You see, I'm a little bit concerned. I don't think I'm making it on the show.
And then proceeded to just give this winning monologue. And that ended all the discussion about
it.
Billy.
Yeah.
That was enough. But the other interesting thing about this star-making quality that the show has is that in the beginning, in keeping with Lorne thinking about his show as an egalitarian enterprise, he never envisioned there being stars. He wanted it to be an ensemble. So during the first season, when Chevy Chase started to emerge as the star and appeared on the cover of New York Magazine, this was not what the plan was. And it threatened actually to destroy the show because it engendered so much jealousy and competition and rancor. And then Chevy left after that season. That was really difficult for the show to absorb. But one of the things that Lawrence learned over the decades is that's what happens. The show will remake itself. Stars will emerge. They will be good for the show, even though they might be tough on morale.
Yeah.
They'll move on. New stars will emerge. The show lives in a perpetual state of regenerating itself. Like the New York Yankees or the Dow, it'll have good years and bad years. And Lauren always likes to say he's lived through so many reviews that are titled Saturday Night Dead. Mm. You know, every few years, the critics hate the show. And you just wait it out and see what happens.
Lorne Michaels is 80 years old now. And I know that there's been a lot of talk about who might be able to take up the mantle. Tina Fey is one of the names that often gets floated as a person who could potentially lead Saturday Night Live if Lorne were to step down. First of all, do you ever see a world in which Lorne might step down? And what happens to SNL after Lorne Michaels?
It's hard for me to picture Lorne stepping away from his show. It's his baby. He created it. It's a family to him. You know, there's a godfather element to the whole enterprise. It's hard to imagine him being replaced wholesale by a single person. It's important to remember that in all the years that he's produced SNL, Lorne has never missed a Saturday night. He's never been home with the flu. He's always there. And that level of dedication, I think most people wouldn't want to sacrifice a certain kind of quality of life to be all in that way. What I think is a likelier scenario is that I could imagine him cutting back slightly on his studio time. But I can't imagine him leaving there unless he was taken out on a stretcher.
Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. This was fun.
Susan Morrison's book, Lorne, The Man Who Invented Saturday Night Live, is out on February 18th. You can find it on Apple Books. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.